You're listening to Talking Baseball with Ed Randall, presented by MLB.com. He's Ed Randall. He's talking baseball. What more do you need?
Hi, everybody. I'm Ed Randall, Big Ed and Nora's baby boy, and welcome back to Ed Randall's Talking Baseball. The week of September 11th is America's saddest when we commemorate the terrorist attacks. On the pile at the World Trade Center searching for survivors was a former first baseman who has the unique distinction of being the only player in uniform for two of baseball's milestone events, Mickey Mantle's 500th home run as a Yankee and Hank Aaron's 715 as a Brave. That was before he gave his life to New York City as a firefighter. We welcome in the heroic Frank Tepidino. Frank, great to have you on the show. I really appreciate it. And everybody is indebted to you for your service. First, let's talk a little baseball. You were drafted out of Brooklyn, New York, by the Baltimore Orioles, and then involved in the Rule 5 draft to the hometown New York Yankees. Tell us about that.
I had signed in 1965. That was the first year of the draft. And in those days, you know, nobody knew what the draft was about. So you always had the scouts that would come down and see you play and say, you know, we're going to draft you and this and that and the other thing. It wound up going through the first draft. I was drafted by Baltimore. And then I had went in the Marine Corps Reserves in 66. And like you said, Baltimore had protected Terry Crowley and didn't protect me. I guess because of the age or because of who got more money. And the Yankees drafted me, myself, and Charlie Sands of the Rule 5. And we both joined the Yankees in 67 at 19 years old.
Because there was an unusual rule in play at that time.
Yes. Yes. You know, you had to spend a year above where they drafted you off. So they drafted us off a AAA roster, so that meant they had to keep us in the major leagues. We were too young. You can't play in the major leagues at 19 with 2 years' experience and you had a year of eight ball under your belt. It just doesn't work that way in that game.
And that rule is no more, but still in all, you're 19 years old, you're on the Yankees bench, and Mickey Mantle is your idol.
Yes. And, he winds up hitting his 500th career home run, you know. And it's just, you look back on it, naturally, and you're saying, what in the world happened? You know, I was there for this, and it's just like, oh, okay, you know, he hit it. Now you look back and you say, oh, my God, that was pretty big, especially in those days. But there was hardly anybody in the stands.
I was just gonna say yeah. That it's completely different than it is now.
Oh yeah, yeah. And the thing that's, I mean, Cleveland's going for this record, and they're only drawing below 30,000 people a game. It's amazing. I thought they'd be sellouts, but I think what Mickey had is, I don't think we had more than 15,000-20,000 people at the game.
And yet, imagine, you're 19 years old, and you get to slap Mickey Mantle on the back after his 500th home run.
Wow. Yeah, you know, you always went by and say, nice shot, Mr. Mantle. You know, that's the way it was in those days.
You go from the Yankees up to the Milwaukee Brewers for a while, and then to the Atlanta Braves. And while you're with the Braves, there on April the 8th, 1974, Al Downing on the mound for the Los Angeles Dodgers in Old Fulton County Stadium, and Hank Aaron's at the plate.
And it's, you know, everybody couldn't wait for him to hit the home run except Hank Aaron himself. He just said, I'm going to hit another one. I just don't know when it's going to be. Everybody's excited about it. He goes, it's a big thing. He goes, but I'm going to hit another one. Don't worry. You know, but it really was, because we built up from the year before in 73, you know, because he had, in 1973, he was 38, 39, and he hit 40 home runs, you know. And that was, nobody saw that coming at that age. And that was the year that we had Darrell Evans, Davey Johnson, and Hank Aaron. All three hit over 40 home runs.
All right, Davey, the first second baseman ever to hit 40 home runs.
Yeah.
Can you compare them as, not as players, but can you compare Mantle and being his teammate with Henry Aaron and being his teammate?
Naturally, you know, two Hall of Famers, two outstanding ball players, but above all, just like everybody says, outstanding teammates, you know. But at 19, you don't look at Mantle as your teammate. He's still your idol. And what was I, 25? Sure, I had a few years. And here I am, you know, playing. You know, you really can't say you played with Hank Aaron. You know, you were on the team when he was playing. That's the difference. You know, you have to cut it somewhere. And I always look back at it like, well, without us, Henry couldn't play the game. You know, he still needed a first baseman. He needed somebody else. He needed nine guys, you know, but absolutely outstanding individuals and just great human beings. They never, ever said anything about their own accomplishments. Everything was about baseball, the team, and how they can help them. That was what was so amazing about the two.
You are renowned for being there when Mickey Mantle hit his 500th and Hank Aaron hit his 715th, but you weren't the only one.
Right, but I was their teammate. I guess that's where the difference comes in. I was a teammate of Mantle and I was a teammate of Aaron.
Right.
But naturally, Al Downing was there, and I believe Davey Johnson, because Mantle hit his against Baltimore, and naturally Davey was on the Atlanta team when Henry had done it.
Right.
You know.
And Downing had been a teammate of Mantle in New York.
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
What a distinction to have seen history in person, not once but twice.
Right. Right. Exactly. And neither time did I take my jacket off. Neither time was I in the game, you know. And the only thing, you know, is like, who's that guy? Oh, okay, that's so and so. Outside of that, you know, it was just one of those things. Yeah.
So you're out of the game after 8 years, and at age 27, what does Frank Tepidino decide he wants to do with his life at that point?
He doesn't know. He's working in a sporting goods store in Port Jefferson.
In Long
Island. And it's funny, too. Yeah, because the owner of the store had signed originally with the New York Yankees, Richie Lenegro. And we became good friends. And then my father-in-law had worked for the New York City Fire Patrol. And what had happened was baseball was on the verge of changing. And what it was through health insurance, you know. Baseball was at such a low cost, and then everything changed. And I had to get into something where I had medical insurance. And at that time, the New York City Fire Patrol was, just an application. And basically, if you pass the test, you know, they hired you.
What is, explain what the Fire Patrol is. It is part of the FDNY, Fire Department in New York?
No. What it is it's run by the insurance company. It did all the salvage work for the merchants. It was formed before the New York City Fire Department. Mm-hmm. And a funny thing was, it had disbanded in 2006, but it was around before the New York City Fire Department. So we did all the salvage work. Firemen had black helmets. We had red helmets. We went in as the fire was going on the floor below and just covered up merchandise and belongings, furniture. This way people didn't have such a big damage. It was very, very rewarding because of the job that you did, you know. And then, like Ed said, everything came down to a specific day where the world had changed.
But your family was one of firefighters beyond yourself.
Yes, my two sons are New York City firemen. My one son's a lieutenant, and my other son just retired last year. And, you know, we never grew up with policemen and firemen, but later on in life, as, you know, as life is, there are twists and turns in it. And the turns were is that they became New York City firemen, and I couldn't be prouder.
Take us to September 11th, 2001. Your home, and what happens?
Well, what happens is my both sons were working, okay? And one was getting off that morning, and we didn't really know where my other son, John, was. And what had happened was my son, Frank, came in, and he says, "Did you see the TV?" I says, "Yeah, it must have been, you know, somebody had a heart attack, a pilot, and the plane went into the World Trade Center." And with that, about another 10 minutes later is when, you know, we were watching and the other plane went in. Then everything just came down to that it's going to be everybody on board and everybody's trying to get to where they could do the most help.
And so you watch this on TV, and immediately you think, "I gotta go."
Right. That was the response of all the anybody that was in any type of service in the city. That was their immediate reaction. Yeah, you know, and then everything naturally had to be coordinated on where you were to go to. Whether you were a policeman, you go to your precinct, or if you were a fireman, you went to your firehouse. And myself being with the patrol, I was based down on West 3rd Street in Greenwich Village.
So you were like 5 minutes. You were like 5 minutes from the World Trade Center.
We were very, very close. I had gone to the World Trade Center probably in my career up to that point 30, 40 times for various trash fires, restaurant fires, you know, and just numerous calls. And the funny thing was, I was there originally for the bombing.
In 1993.
Right. I was there for that, yeah.
So you decide, I got to go in, I got to help, it's chaotic. Who's in the car with you?
It was myself and another gentleman that worked with me, a guy named Mike Markey. And my other son was working. We didn't know where he was exactly till later on. And then my one son got in touch with his cousin, and they went another route. They went uptown Manhattan. So we went in at that point just to try and see what we could do.
How long did it take from being in Eastern Long Island to get to the World Trade Center that morning?
Well, what they had done was they had set up certain designated areas that you could more or less just breeze right through. Naturally, you had some sort of identification, but we all had our turnout gear with us, so it was more or less probably an hour and a half to 2 hour ride to get in at that particular point.
And you had probably never seen so many emergency vehicles in your life.
I had never seen anything like that. And I don't think the world would have yet. It was just, I mean, as you look back on it, naturally, when you're standing in the middle of it, it's just mind-boggling. And it just, you've heard the word surreal so many times that it just looked like it was out of a movie set. You didn't think anything could be possible in real life, you know, but it was.
Frank Tepidino is with us, 8 years in the major leagues, and many more years than that as a member of the New York Fire Patrol, and got to the pile hours after the cataclysmic events of September 11th. When you first got there and looked at this, I can't imagine what must have gone through your mind.
No, because it was just... Before that, one night we had a fire uptown, and they were filming, and it sounds silly, they were filming Godzilla, And what it was is we had made a turn down a Broadway and more or less ran into police that were taking care of that area. And it was unbelievable because of all the apparatus, all the spotlights and everything. And they were doing a filming. And it was just phenomenal. And I always refer back to it because September 11th, when we had first went on the scene, and we wound up getting there later on that night, and it just looked surreal, like I had said, and it was just spotlights and everybody just looking at a structure that was no longer there, just twisted steel, and it was like, this is not a film, this is real, you know, and to find, you know, time had passed. You know, like I said, it went from a recovery mission into a rescue, you know, and then it sort of flip-flopped. Now it wasn't really rescue, now it was recovery because of the time that went by.
But when you get there, your instinct is this is going to be rescue. And it becomes apparent not that long thereafter that now it's about recovery.
Right, right. And everybody, you know, nobody just ran and took control of anything. Everything was coordinated that you had to, more or less, it wasn't like, I guess if you could say it was the officer in charge, he had to go to a staging area, basically tell them who was there, how many men he had, and then what they did was they told you what you were going to do, where you were going to go, what area, and what you were going to do. There were so many things going on that it was not chaotic to a point that, you know, here, you have 10 men with you. What you're going to do is you're going to take 10 brooms and you're going to go and sweep the street. It sounds like it's not doing a rescue or a recovery job, but what you were doing was cleaning the street, moving the debris so the scuba divers can open up a manhole cover, go down the sewer system so they could get underneath the World Trade Center and have easier access to get in. All the things they did were for a reason.
What were the shifts like?
The shifts were 12-hour shifts, you know, but you didn't spend 12 hours there. You had to wait for another detail to relieve you, and then you went back, and then you more or less got a couple hours downtime, and then you, if they needed you, you returned, and then what you did was you continued either that night or the following day.
And you were there for how long?
We were there for the first 4 days, and then we were relieved, and then we more or less started to go into a schedule where you would work 24 off 24 and then return for another 24, then off 48. So it was all shifts that they had to put everybody on.
So for those first 4 days,
yeah,
you never went home?
No, we didn't go home. We stayed. No, we stayed. Oh, everybody stayed in the firehouse. We had firemen from Chicago that stayed. We had some from Texas. In other words, all doors were open. And, you know, whoever needed a place to stay, that's what we did. You know, we just brought guys in and just put them up. So they went down and they gave their services also.
Frank Tepidino with us on Ed Randall's Talking Baseball. Do you recall what your emotions were like during those 4 days?
Well, we had lost one of the guys, Keith Romer, from our firehouse. He was the youngest kid there, and he was a big Yankee fan. But, you know, working...
I heard he kept a Yankees cap in his fire truck.
Right. That was the only thing that we had found on the truck. And I had gotten in touch with Bobby Mercer, God bless him, at that particular time. And he had set up a few things with the family. But the thing years working in the city is that I came across probably more than half of them, whether it be at a softball game or a function they had to raise money to help for a disaster somewhere in the country, or just firehouses getting together. Yeah. And at regular fires during the course of everyday working all those years, I ran across a lot of the guys. And just to think that none of them are going home. Outside of them, policemen, Port Authority cops, sanitation workers, regular civilians, you know, it's just something that you don't think about it constantly as it was at that particular time. But every now and then, you know, especially this time of the year, it just pops up. Or if you happen to see a show that was made before 2001 that shows the World Trade Center in it, a movie or something like that, it always comes back. Say, my God, remember when, you know, back in the day when, you know, we would respond down there, things like that, or the friends that you lost and the people, things like that.
The young firefighter that was in the house with you who lost his life tragically, in preparing for this interview, I also read that you lost a college teammate who was in one of the buildings.
Yes. You know, and it's those things that, you know, you don't realize at that particular time, but you know, you look back and you say, my God, you know, I remember, you know, so-and-so, and these things happen, you know, and after you see everything's all said and done on how many people and how many people somewhere along the line, whether you went to school with or you just came, you know, passing, knowing so many people, working in the city for so many years, yeah.
And being there was much worse. It looked to you much worse than we could see watching it on television.
Well, it's like going to a movie set and watching them film the movie or watching it on a screen. It's like night and day. You don't. It's the feel of the area. It's the smell. It's the people, it's the chaotic, and then again, it's quiet, and you just have so many things that just change your emotion so quickly and constantly.
And when you think about 9/11, Frank, there's anger and there's sadness.
It's anger over the people that did it to the World Trade Center, to the Pentagon, to Pennsylvania. You know, there's so many pieces that are there. It's not a race. It's not a nationality. It's not a religion. It's individuals that decided to break away from society and cause chaos on something that they believe in. Instead of taking care of it, talking about it, or showing action that you have a valid point, they've gone to the extreme. These are the people that you're annoyed at, that you hate, you can't stand, you can't change, you can't reason with. As far as the other people, they are caught up in something that they have no control over. There are good people, okay? They just happen to be targeted as a big picture, and it's completely wrong. Everyone deserves, okay, to be heard. Everyone deserves to have a voice, okay? Don't shut their voice down because of someone else. Let them say something. And if the world can change something, okay. Me, I live my life as doing the best I possibly can. I try and help the person next to me. I try try and help the person behind me, and I try and help the person in front of me. That's the way I live.
As the years have passed, and it was a day that changed your life forever, is it a little bit more palatable for you?
It is, you know, because they're gone, okay, and they're all at rest, you know, and you just know they're at peace now. It wasn't a way that anybody chooses to go. It was horrific. It was needless, okay, but as years go by, you know, it's like everything else. It's like losing a loved one, losing whether it be a mom, whether it be a dad. It's so traumatic at first that as the years go by, it becomes less and less painful, and you can accept it, you can live with it, and you can move on. As a race and as a nation, as part of the, you know, the human race, you have to move on. You can't hold things against someone forever and ever. Basically, the people that did this are gone. You know, a lot of them. So, I mean, that's it, you know. So.
Before you go, I wanted to talk about running the Firefighters Charitable Foundation. Tell us about that.
Well, what we do is we give out money to people that have been affected by whether it be a fire, whether it be a disaster, whether there's an individual that needs medical attention. And what we do is we try and help them across the United States. And I've been doing it for 10 years, and it is really satisfying, and it gives me just a happiness that I know that I can help an individual and help people out there, you know. And we have a dinner this November, and this year we're going to honor Bobby Valentine for a lot of the work that he does. He does that with yourself for Fam for the Cure. And I thought he would be a great recipient, and I thank you for steering our way. And naturally, we have about 15 to 20 other Major League Baseball players that show up. And it's just a great evening. And, you know, we normally get 250, 300 people. But the whole thing of the foundation is to help people.
And if people want to contribute, Frank, how can they do so?
Well, what they can do is they can either get in touch with myself at firefighters, FFCF. .org, or okay, they can pick up the phone and give us a call. It's 516-249-0332. Okay, and just $1, $5, $10, and we use all our money to help people that are, like I said, have either been afflicted by fire or disaster, and now, you know, with all this the hurricanes and everything, we're on a verge of sending, you know, a large amount of money to Texas. And in return, we'll be sending money to Florida to help the people out. Normally, what we try and do is, it's so hard to help the individuals at a disaster, is that we know there were firehouses that were lost in Texas and firehouses that were lost in Florida. So we send our money directly to the firehouses. And if they need that money to rebuild, they use it. Or if they need it to help people in their district, they give those people money from what we send.
And for your service to the city of New York, to this country, being on that pile in the immediate aftermath of the greatest terrorist attack on this soil, and for the weeks thereafter, we owe you a tremendous debt of gratitude.
Well, I thank you, but no one owes me anything. Like I said, I was just one part of a mass amount of people. people that help from every walk of life. I just happen to be in a certain position and a certain area that I can contribute very, very little. But thank you. And thank you to every other individual that put 1 second into helping us grow as a nation. Thanks, Ed.
So that'll do it for Frank Tepidino and myself on MLB.com. If you're on the move, thanks for the ride, and thanks for listening to Ed Randall's Talking Baseball.